Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
This is ABC Radio National, the network that specialises in complexity. Hello, I'm Robin Williams. And complexity is a very good thing, as you'll hear. Today's science show is full of it. Complex fish, sponges in space, and a Nobel laureate saying biology is becoming as complex as physics. Actually, this week there's been a great big complexity conference in southern Queensland, and one of its organisers, Peter Lindsay, told us how complexity theory can make passenger planes even more efficient.
Emirates and Air Services Australia, the air traffic provider here, are conducting experiments where they fly different routes from Dubai to the East Coast cities in Australia. And the shortest route, the Great Circle route, would take you over Central Australia, coming down from Dubai. But they've found that by getting in the jet stream, by travelling as much as 1,200 miles south of the nominal route, they're able to save more than an hour off the flight time. So that route, for example, might take them down south of Perth, and they'd come in over Portland and Victoria to go up to Sydney. So a really completely different route.
That's hitchhiking a ride on the wind.
When you get tailwinds of 200 miles an hour, 300 kilometres an hour at the right altitudes, for much of the flight, you can save a tonne of fuel an hour off the flight.
That doesn't make the plane feel unstable or anything, does it, hurtling around like that?
No, if you get in the middle of the jet stream, it's quite stable. It's a well-defined tube of air if you get right in the middle of it. But the trouble is it moves around from day to day, from month to month, which has meant that the old ways of doing air traffic control on fixed routes, flying between beacons, you just couldn't take advantage of that. But now with modern technology, GPS, things like that, they can move the route around from day to day, following the winds. But now we have to develop the air traffic control procedures so that it's safe, so that the air traffic controllers know what's going on.
Which always helps. Peter Lindsay is the Boeing Professor of Systems Engineering at the University of Queensland and Director of the ARC Centre for Complex Systems. He sees their work solving the problems of delays, congestion and waste in aviation, an industry where the traffic is growing ever larger.
Yes, they're saying in the Western world it could double in less than 15 years or maybe even treble, people aren't sure. And in the developing world it's much higher than that, it's 40% in China and India per year at the moment.
Okay, the industry is kind of safe. The accidents are reported in the press simply because they're so rare, but what do you think that will do to congestion and the general mess and delays and sorts of environmental concerns that we've got more and more used to associating with aviation?
The air traffic management system is at some kind of choke point at the moment, which means that even if traffic is not necessarily increasing that quickly, in Australia it's about 6%, the amount of delays are rising quite astronomically, 40% a couple of years ago, rising to 70%, and in the US, of course, they're always complaining, worst year ever.
And of course the delays mean you're not just sitting there waiting to go away from the terminal, what you're doing is sitting on the tarmac burning fuel.
Yes, or in the air burning fuel, and that's a huge contributor to greenhouse gas emissions as we know these days, especially when it's burnt at high altitude.
What's the case for saying that the system is inefficient and, as, say, The Economist indicated a few weeks ago, that you can, in fact, halve these particular costs?
There's anecdotal evidence that about 40% of fuel costs in Europe, for example, are down to air traffic control. That is, the kind of delays you get, putting holding patterns, taking longer routes, that kind of thing. And the hope is that all that can be improved, but the current way of doing things, it's doubtful that that could be improved while keeping current safety standards. So we really need a new way of doing things.
And of course, before you give me the details, there's the American system of going back to the hub where you actually do a dogleg. You don't go directly to your destination. You go to the headquarters, if you like, airport, and then you go on to somewhere. So you actually travel a third more than you need.
That's true, and with the larger aircraft like the A380s, that's probably going to happen even more. Then again, there are modern aircraft, the new Boeing Dreamliner, which uses 20% less fuel and could go as far as an 18-hour flight. Not that everyone will necessarily want to go for an 18-hour flight, but that raises the possibility of more point-to-point flights, so you can avoid the hub-and-spoke models that we traditionally use.
Yes, we talked about the Dreamliner actually from Seattle a few years ago on the Science Show. How have you, Peter, been analysing all this?
I've been working, or our centre has been working, mostly in the air traffic control side of things, and we're using complex system science insights to look at new ways of doing things. So, for example, the way birds fly through the air in flocks, they do that very efficiently. If you've ever seen them in flocks of hundreds or even thousands, and they all manage to get through the air evidently without crashing into each other and land in the tree at pretty much the same time. So there are lessons there. Of course, we don't know that we can apply those directly to air traffic control.
Landing in the tree might be a hazard.
Might be a hazard. But we certainly get insights into the way they cooperate and navigate together, and we think that has great potential for getting around weather, for example. If all the aircraft apply much the same manoeuvre, then they can stay together in a flock. And there are other efficiencies to be had. A lot of the international travel into Australia, a lot of the international flights come down in groups. They tend to leave Los Angeles or across the Pacific or come down from Southeast Asia pretty much the same time of day for marketing reasons or whatever. And if they could be flown in a flock, we figure we can get much better safety by having an air traffic controller manage that flock of aircraft, as it were.
How many in the flock?
Well, if you leave LA at midnight during the week, it's not surprising to see 8 or 10 flights coming to the east coast of Australia, maybe even to Sydney alone.
Well, that would presumably cause absolute chaos at the airport, with vast queues getting through the security and getting through immigration and so on.
They wouldn't fly as a flock the whole time, of course. That's the trick, is to space them out appropriately when they arrive and to try and guarantee that their trajectory will be intervention-free, so that they'll be able to fly the most efficient route, which might not necessarily be the most straight route, in fact, but guarantee that they won't get any delays put on them by air traffic control.
It's suggested that the air traffic control in the United States is archaic, mainly because of the kind of rules that are enforced, and that an improvement there in that country alone with the huge amount of flying could have colossal savings. Would you agree with that?
Everyone says that. They missed an opportunity after September 11 when air traffic dropped significantly to upgrade their systems. And I think they're regretting it now because it really is a choke point. They're using technology that's 50 years old in some cases. They're using procedures that are 50 years old.
Now, you did say at the beginning that there's a toss-up between safety and turnover. How much do you think we are inevitably going to have to sacrifice safety?
The airline industry is very conservative, very concerned about safety. So safety is always foremost. That's been part of the reason for not taking up new techniques, because it's so difficult to establish in real life the safety of the new ways of doing things. So there's a lot of experimentation needed, not in real life, but computer models and those kind of things. That's where we're trying to help.
Are you not suggesting that air travel is going to become more dangerous?
The safety standards, as I say, are very strict and very highly maintained. But with the amount of traffic, it's almost inevitable. People say that we'll soon move to a situation where there might be one air crash a day, even.
If you compare some of the figures with cars that we take for granted, I think there are figures given the other day in China, 200 people on average a day killed as a result of car crashes, which, if it were the equivalent in planes, would be on the front page every day.
That's right, yes. Now, there are several orders of magnitude in risk difference. It's well known that air travel is far safer than being a pedestrian, for example. So it's a matter of perceived risk, but it's the air crashes that get in the news each night, and people worry particularly about the lack of control, it seems.
How hopeful are you that the figures for greenhouse, which is, I think, the contribution is something like 3%, comes from planes, and the effect in the sky through various levels of flying are particularly severe. How much do you think that can be alleviated by being more efficient?
As I said, aircraft are improving all the time, aircraft engines. So there's good scope for continual improvement in that area. From the air traffic management viewpoint, it's harder to tell. Certainly, the way things go at the moment, 40% of fuel usage in Europe is due to air traffic control interventions. That could be brought down, the economist, as you said, to 12%, and I think that's credible.
What about the techniques of not starting up the engines until you're actually on the runway and being taxied out by one of those little pushers instead?
There are many things that could contribute. That undoubtedly would contribute, especially since we'd prefer to absorb a lot of the delay. If you do have to have delay, you'd prefer to absorb it on the ground without the engines running.
Peter Lindsay at the Complexity Conference held on the Gold Coast this week. He's Professor of Systems Engineering at the University of Queensland. And one place where the flight congestion isn't quite so bad is around Saturn, where some remarkable discoveries are still being made by the intrepid spacecraft Cassini. Here's Chris Smith in Cambridge.
Ask someone to name the most exciting planet in the solar system, and apart from Earth, they'll inevitably say Saturn. Most people are transfixed by the ring system, but also tucked away in orbit are some of the most intriguing moons that we know about, including one called Hyperion, which resembles a giant piece of sponge. In fact, sponge is quite appropriate because 40% of it's empty space. But how did it get like that? Well, two papers in this week's edition of the Nature podcast have made use of the Cassini spacecraft, which arrived at Saturn in 2004, to take a closer look. Here's Carolyn Porco.
Hyperion is a smallish moon. It's about 270 kilometers across, a very irregularly shaped moon. In fact, it's the largest irregularly shaped moon we have in the solar system, and it was surprising even before we got there with Cassini, because it's a tumbling moon. It doesn't spin nice and uniformly like all the other bodies. It tumbles through space, so that was one clue that it was a strange moon. And then when we got there with Cassini, one flyby was very close, and we got beautiful views of the surface, and the surface is certainly the most unusual-looking surface in the solar system.
Why is that?
Well, if you were to look at Hyperion, you would think that it was a cosmic sponge, like it was something that someone had grabbed out of the ocean, a very large ocean. It is pockmarked with craters, and they're very close together, and they're very deep-looking, and the craters are very fresh and well-preserved-looking. So it doesn't look like the normal cratered surface we see in the solar system, where generally the craters are somewhat eroded and subdued, and there's ejecta that covers the surfaces of the craters, and it tends to make things soft-looking. On Hyperion, things do not look soft-looking.
Do you know why?
Well, we think now we do know why. We were able to fly by Hyperion and measure the slight change in the velocity of Cassini, and that tells us how massive the body is. And, of course, from the images, we know how big it is, and we can measure its volume. We put that together with the size of the body, and that tells us its density. And so on Hyperion, we now know its density. Its density is surprisingly low.
So it really is like a sponge.
Well, you sort of could think of it that way. Actually, the way we think of it is that its density is very low. It's about a half a gram per centimeter cubed. That's about half the density of water.
And this density that you're seeing is like that because it's such a porous structure.
Well, they go hand in hand. It's porous because it's underdense, or it's underdense because it's porous. The question is, why are either of those circumstances holding for Hyperion when the bodies around it have higher densities? So that's a puzzle. But in any case, the result of its low density is that when a crater is made, when an impactor comes and plows into the surface of Hyperion, because the body is so undermassive for its size, the ejecta, most of it escapes. And it does not come back down on the surface, either fill in smaller craters or make the larger craters look smoother. So we think that's why Hyperion has a sponge-like appearance.
Any other interesting changes that you see on the surface of the moon when you take these very careful pictures that you've got in your paper?
Oh, yeah. We see another thing that's just so striking. The craters have dark materials on the floors of them. And what's interesting is that the visual and infrared mapping spectrometers and the other spectrometers on Cassini have measured the composition of that.
Well, let's bring in Dale Cruikshank, who's author of a second paper in Nature this week. Dale, you've used some of those instruments and you've got an analysis of what the surface composition of Hyperion is. What did you find?
That's right, Chris. As Carolyn noted, the Cassini spacecraft carries a wonderful complement of very, very capable instruments. And basically what we find is the surface of Hyperion is made of dirty water ice. Normal fresh fallen snow or fresh ice exposures have a very high reflectivity, yet Hyperion does not. And so the conclusion we reach from that is that the ice is not fresh and pure, but dirty. And we can even speculate now as to what some of that dirty material is. As Carolyn notes, this dark, dirty stuff appears to be concentrated or ponded in the bottom of some, but not all of these craters. And with the mapping spectrometers aboard Cassini, we've been able to focus in on those concentrations of the dark stuff. and find that it indeed is well matched by complex organic material that we can synthesize in the lab, and also that we can extract from certain kinds of meteorites, and as well that we find in interstellar dust, and also appears in comets. So what we're finding is a common thread, in my view, that organic material of the kind dusting the surface of the Hyperion and concentrating in the bottoms of the craters, maybe this same organic stuff that we find widespread not only in the solar system, but throughout our galaxy and other galaxies as well.
Do you think that Hyperion is unique, or do you think that we're very likely to see the same thing cropping up elsewhere in the solar system and beyond?
You know, almost everything that we visit in the solar system is unique, and I wouldn't be surprised if Hyperion remains that way, even as we explore other bodies. But let me go on to one other really important finding that, in fact, may be a key to some of Hyperion's strange characteristics, and that is we find carbon dioxide ice, CO2 ice, all over the surface of Hyperion. So we're exploring that in detail, but the information we get from the VIMS instrument, that is this mapping spectrometer on the Cassini spacecraft, is that the carbon dioxide ice is attached to some other molecule, almost certainly H2O, and the details of that, which we remain to be puzzled out, make Hyperion unique so far in the solar system.
Which I guess we'll just have to watch this space for more fertile findings from Dale. But Carolyn, that must add quite a bit to effectively what your imaging first flushed out.
Oh, yes, it does. In fact, it draws a connection between Hyperion and the other bodies like Iapetus, and then there's Phoebe and so on in the Saturnian system. And that's precisely what we want to know when we go to a place like Saturn with a spacecraft like Cassini, is just what does the whole planetary system tell us about not only how that particular planetary system came to be, but how the whole planet formation process works, and perhaps the interchange of materials among the bodies, and what do their physical characteristics and the trends in them with distance from the primary body mean. So as I'm listening to Dale, my head is spinning with questions that I'd love to ask him, and I know we'll probably be doing this around tables at future Cassini meetings.
Carolyn Porco from the Space Science Institute in Boulder, Colorado, and Dale Cruikshank, who's at the NASA Ames Research Center. They've got two papers in Nature this week looking at the structure of Saturn's moon Hyperion, the only moon in the solar system, as far as we know, that's 40% empty space.
Thanks, Chris. Chris Smith, our complex and naked reporter in Cambridge. Now some complex fish. Here's a fellow who divides his time between studying fish and running a bank. George, how did you become a banker?
It came from work that Bob May and I had done in the early 90s that showed how you could forecast chaotic systems.
Bob May being, of course, the Australian who went on to become president of the Royal Society of London, and he's now Lord May, so he's a mathematician. You were doing maths with him.
That's right, yeah. Bob became famous and I just tried to become rich.
So. And you became a banker, managing director of the Deutsche Bank, was it?
I was the managing director for Deutsche Bank, yeah.
George Sugihara, whose career shows how the new science of complexity can take you anywhere, from sorting the forces in finance to trying to save the world's fisheries. But having got rich, why come back to science at the Scripps Institution?
I think it was the science, basically. I mean, the view is awfully nice. But, you know, you have to understand this was a difficult decision to make, because my initial plan was to take a one-year leave of absence to build this thing and then come back. I'm a science junkie. I love it. But I ended up spending 5 years at the bank. So
the salaries are slightly different in banking, aren't they?
Yeah, that was the other part of it. It is, you know, we all have feet of clay at some point. And, no, it was very glamorous and alluring in that way. But I think you only need a certain amount of money. And once you have a reasonable sort of ballast, as it were, you can go on and do other things. So now I can afford to be a philanthropist. You know, now I can afford to do things with social conscience.
Which is how we get back to fish. Studying, as you said, the populations, looking at the maths with Bob May, again, the Australian, at fish populations. What have you found out about them? Because we're extremely worried that fish populations around the world in all the fisheries are going down. What are the complexities of that statement?
Yeah, well, I think there are three factors that are kind of interrelated that may not seem so immediately that all come together to cause this problem. I think the first one is that the science that's being used to inform fisheries management is not all that great. And I know this is something that Bob has worked on for a long time, and I'm just coming newly to this. But a lot of the classical fisheries theory really, to my mind anyhow, has more the look of classical myth and does not fit reality very well. And I think most fisheries managers would agree to that. In fact, Dick Beamish, who's head of the Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans, was sitting in the chair that you're sitting in right now about 2 years ago. And he was saying, he was basically wringing his hands and saying that these fisheries models are extremely good at saying what already happened. They're very good at capturing past patterns, but they fail miserably at saying what's going to happen next. It's the same thing in banking. You know, you get these people coming to you with these great models that fit the past wonderfully, but they tell you nothing about what's going to happen next, have absolutely no predictability. So in fisheries, the lack of predictability, I think, is the sort of the ultimate testament of the failing of the general conception. And my feeling about this is that rather than just saying, so it's easy to say negative things about things that have failed, but I think to suggest a positive alternative, and that's that one can use some of these nonlinear time series techniques, some of these sort of complex systems ideas, basically, to look at this problem instead of as a single species problem, to look at it as a kind of an ecosystem, a complex system problem of interrelated parts, and make reasonably accurate forecasts. And the interesting thing about that is that what those findings have suggested is that traditional fisheries management that depends on conceptions like maximum sustainable yield are actually based on a fiction. Maximum sustainable yield implies the existence of equilibrium, et cetera. Those things are a fiction, and that was the subject of one of the Nature papers that was published in 2005. We looked at data for the North Pacific and over the 20th century and found, in fact, that these populations were not in equilibrium and that they exhibited erratic ups and downs that were more characteristic of nonlinear systems. So the fact that maximum sustainable yield implies the existence of a simple production function, of a simple equilibrium, suggests, and the fact that that's in fact enshrined in the Magnuson-Stevens Act, enshrined in legislation, that legislation is basically enshrining a fiction. And the bottom line is that we need a way of looking at these systems that I think lines up more reasonably with reality. So that's really the first point. The second point is, again, as it applies to policy, is that traditionally fisheries are managed by specifying landing targets or specifying catch limits. This kind of management, and this is the work that Bob and John Beddington were involved in, I believe it's inadequate, and it's based on another study that we published fairly recently, just last fall in Nature, that was really addressing a 30-year-old debate over whether fishing will increase variability or decrease variability of populations. And this was actually a debate that both John Beddington and Robert May were central figures of back in the 70s. So the problem is that, you know, then we didn't have data to solve it. In fact, the background for this debate goes back to the sardine collapse in Cannery Row in the late 40s. Back then, it was not known whether the collapse was due to fishing, which is what people at the California Department of Fish and Game thought, or to a change in climate, which is basically what the industry stakeholders and which actually the federal investigator who came in believed. So the problem with that is that you can't really separate fishing effects from environmental effects. I mean, there's a catch-22 in fisheries data. Fisheries data only contains data on fished species. It's based on landings. Whereas what you really need to resolve this controversy is data on both fished and unexploited species living in the same environment so that you can factor out the environment as the cause. So as a consequence of this sardine problem, they implemented this very ambitious sampling program called the CalCOFI, California Cooperative Oceanic Fisheries Investigation. Extremely ambitious spatially across the California Current. It was actually bigger when it began, but has continued on for more than 50 years and is probably the largest non-fishery-based database that we have for marine organisms. So what the CalCOFI data showed us, in fact, because we could actually separate fishing effects from environmental effects, showed us that fishing actually tends to increase variability of populations. It promotes boom and bust fluctuations in populations. And these boom and busts, we believe, are due to the fact that fishing tends to selectively cull these populations, selectively focus on the larger individuals first. And so you go from a population of that's with a very spread out demographic of very old to very young individuals to a population that effectively consists of near juveniles.
And they are, in fact, the less fertile, funnily enough. It's the it's the older fish that tend to be more productive of offspring. And so what you're really shattering the numbers, aren't you, by getting rid of the bigger fish?
You're getting rid of the bigger fish that are more active reproductively, but you're also getting rid of fish that can weather environmental storms. So things like El Nino and so forth. You're getting rid of fish that add continuity and buffering capacity to populations.
Some people have said the old line of catching only the bigger fish and throwing the little ones away may indeed be wrong.
It's exactly opposite. It's completely backwards. What they should be doing is figuring out some way to preserve the bigger fish in the environment and focus instead on the smaller and sort of more intermediate-sized fish.
What about the third factor that you mentioned?
The third one actually comes from the second, the second one is that fishing itself increases variability, risk, and uncertainty in that entire industry. And curiously, that industry is one that lacks an organized, transparent marketplace. It's a huge industry. The ex-vessel revenues from fishing in 2000 were on the order of $82 billion. So when that translates to the processor level, wholesaler level, retail level, you're talking of a multiple of like 5 to 7. We're talking about something worldwide that's on the order of $500 billion. Now, the global defense budget is $600 billion. So we're talking about something that's kind of on the order of global defense, but it has no organized market. It's hard to believe. And not only does it not have an organized market, it lacks derivatives. It's a very risky industry, you know, fish variability and volatility in fish prices. But there is no way for people in that industry to moderate their risk using derivatives instruments. So, you know, what does that have to do with sustainability, though? Derivatives, I think, decouple the natural perverse effects that markets might have on a limited resource. So normally you think supply and demand here. Think as a resource gets scarce, the price goes up, which increases the incentive to go out and exploit it more. So that's why a lot of conservationists think markets are evil because of that particular positive feedback. Granted. However, if you can somehow decouple that feedback, I think you can do a lot for sustainability. And in particular, derivatives such as futures and forward contracts are a way of decoupling the supply-demand price dynamic. So as an example, the oil shortage we had recently drove oil prices up to beyond $80 a barrel. If there were not contracts in place that were negotiated 3 or 5 years ago for $40 a barrel, the spot price could have gone easily, you know, above 100 or so. So the fact that there were these forward contracts that were negotiated long ago helped to moderate the current price. So whenever you speculate on a forward price, you tend to speculate on a kind of a moderate level, as opposed to in the extremes. And that kind of hedging ability is very good for stabilizing prices, and it's also really good for the industry. The more you can hedge, and hedging is basically a way of transferring and using these derivatives products. It's basically a way of transferring your risk from the industry to speculators, basically, who are willing to accept that risk. So people in Chicago and New York, who in fact will then use that risk to hedge some other risk. So it's a way of kind of entering into this financial insurance scheme, as it were.
Well, looking out to the ocean with real fish in it, who don't necessarily know what their future is, the sort of speculations that you describe, if you were not necessarily backing banking, but backing policy, and you had to run the world's fisheries, in a couple of lines, what would you do?
Well, I think the first thing that I would do is revise the science, to use science that has good predictive power, real predictive, not descriptive power, but predictive power, so that we would at least be getting good scientific advice. I think the second thing I would do is promote the installation of marine protected areas, because this is certainly a way of protecting the larger, older individuals. And I think the third thing I would do is to try to create transparent open markets in fisheries and to encourage the use of financial instruments that basically allow you to harness market forces for marine conservation. So, you know, markets will evolve eventually. However, we have a chance now to see how they do evolve and to make sure that they do evolve in a way that promotes sustainability.
Some really far-reaching ideas there from George Sugihara, Professor of Biological Oceanography at the Scripps Institution in La Jolla, California. And he was also MD of Deutsche Bank. This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National, where we now turn to the complexities of fishing and the plight of the albatross. James Woodford.
It's winter and freezing. with a chill, dry, southerly breeze, Lindsay Smith from the Southern Ocean Seabird Study Association and I are hunting albatross. Oddly, our search begins not in Antarctica or in mountainous seas south of Tasmania, but on the roof of the Biological Sciences Building at the University of Wollongong, an hour and a half south of Sydney. I am sceptical. How is it possible, I think to myself, that we will be able to spot a wandering albatross several kilometres inland from the ocean? From our aerie, even the vast tankers anchored offshore from Wollongong waiting to get into port look small. But after only a couple of minutes, Lindsay sees one and then another. I'm still baffled. Like 60-litre water containers floating out there, 2 o'clock, behind the big tree. He passes me binoculars, and sure enough, bobbing in the swell is a huge white blob. A wandering albatross, Lindsay says with excitement. An hour later, we are pounding past the Bulambi seawall and heading out to sea in a rickety tinny, proudly emblazoned with the words, New South Wales Albatross Study Group. Whales, white sharks, and other marine creatures may well be the megafauna of the marine environment, but wanderers are the megafauna of the air. The birds have the biggest wingspan on the planet, as vast as 3.5 metres, and they have inspired seafarers and writers for hundreds of years. But wanderers are in desperate straits. Lindsay's achievement of helping raise the alarm about one of the ocean's most magnificent and romantic creatures has won him this year's Cervente Conservation Award for an individual outstanding in their commitment to the preservation of Australian wildlife. Lindsay would describe himself as an amateur marine ornithologist, and yet he is one of the nation's most prominent examples of how much a so-called amateur can achieve. He is undoubtedly one of the world's leading experts on wandering albatross, and he has helped keep alive one of the longest-running wildlife surveys on the planet, half a century to date. It was data from this annual monitoring program which helped establish that longline fishing vessels were rapidly sending albatross towards extinction. His citation for the Cervente Award said, "This represents one of the longest continuous albatross studies in the world." He was involved in the foundation of the Southern Ocean Seabird Study Association in 1994. As a result of Soss's work, the plight of albatrosses and other seabirds was brought to the attention not only of Australians, but of people throughout the world. Bulambi, north of Wollongong, seems the least likely place for one of the planet's great migratory events, and yet it is one of the very few, if not the only spot, away from the frigid breeding grounds where wanderers can be caught relatively easily. They arrive each year to feast on dead and dying cuttlefish. The albatross gorge up to 5 kilograms of free protein, and by the end of a single meal can be so full they are incapable of flying properly for hours and can be netted from the tinny. They return to this coast, not every year, but often enough that scientists can gain a glimpse into their life history. While the cuttlefish only live for a year, an individual wandering albatross may glide around the globe for decades. Considering the challenges they face, their longevity is astonishing. A wanderer banded off Wollongong in 1959, 2 years before John F. Kennedy became the President of the United States, was recaptured in 2001 and will probably still be flying for years to come. Only one other animal, the Andean condor, is a more massive flying creature. Lindsay explains that in the early 1970s, albatross numbers began to dwindle. No longer, he says, were the birds to be seen in their hundreds. An initial explanation for their decline was the closure in 1969 of the Malabar Ocean sewerage outfall, which provided a ready supply of easy protein for the scavengers. However, by the early 1990s, the birds had all but gone from the inshore areas. In a normal season, we could expect to capture over 100 individuals within 10 kilometres of shore, Lindsay says. By the end of the century, we were managing to catch fewer than 10 individuals for the entire season. In 2003, none whatsoever were caught inshore, and the same in 2006. Far offshore last year, on a chartered fishing trawler, Saucer, had one spectacular day where 32 wanderers were caught, but they were the diminutive New Zealand species. The big snowy wanderers now make up as little as 3% of all saucer's catch. It's terrifying that the birds are disappearing, Lindsay says. They're going, they're on their way to extinction. Since the mid-90s, I've made a number of voyages with saucer. In July and August of 2004, Lindsay, his wife, Janice Jenkins-Smith, and I caught 7 wanderers. This is the known record of just one of those birds. Legband CSIRO 1403742 was placed on a wandering albatross captured at sea off Wollongong on July 9th, 1978, by members of the New South Wales Albatross Study Group. No measurements were taken then other than observations of her plumage. The bird was not seen or recaptured until August 13th, 1988. The only additional data collected then was bill length, which was 148.5 millimetres. The bird had disappeared until Lindsay, Janice and I netted the old female on the 1st of August 2004. When the white giant was hauled aboard, her wingspan was almost as great as the length of our small boat. For at least 26 years, she had lived just metres above the ferocious Southern Ocean. If the threats posed by man can be avoided, she will continue to wander long into this century. With several million kilometres of wear scored on its surface, the old band, one of the more travelled pieces of metal ever forged, was removed and replaced with a new one, 140548. So how good are her chances? As I held this bird, beautiful and calm beyond belief, I finally understand why people respond so strongly to these vast creatures. I think to myself, it is no wonder ornithologist and author Robert Cushman Murphy exclaimed ecstatically in his diary on the day he first saw a wanderer, October 1912. I now belong to a higher cult of mortals, for I have seen the albatross.
James Woodford, whose book featuring the magnificent wandering bird is titled Whitecap, just out. Well, coming up on ABC Television on Tuesday, a report with implications for global warming. Mark Corcoran up a mountain in South America where the snow isn't what it used to be.
How many years before all the glaciers around La Paz are gone?
It's around 20 years.
20 years?
20 years.
And they'll all be gone?
Yes.
For 2 million people living under the mountains in the cities of La Paz and El Alto, that means losing up to 60% of their water, which comes from glaciers. It's a huge dilemma for all the Andes region, potentially affecting tens of millions of people.
It's a critical problem. It's the same problem for Peru, Ecuador and Colombia, all the Andes.
So we're talking about the drinking water for millions of people just going.
And you can see Mark Corcoran's report this coming Tuesday on ABC Television about 9:30 in the evening. Meanwhile, in London, trouble with bones. Naomi Fowler.
So I'm just coming into an exhibition, London Before London, it's called. Artifacts from a time long before London ever existed. And the Thames Valley was home to communities of hunters, herders and farmers. Now I'm just looking at the Shepperton woman, who is dated from around 3640 to 3100 BC, and she's lying what remains of her, just the skull and some of the part of the leg bones, part of the arm and some of the finger bones, very slight traces of the pelvis remaining, and she's actually curled up in a fetal position, between 30 and 40 years old. close study showed that her teeth were worn but free from disease. Until the Human Tissue Act came into force in 2004, most British museums weren't actually allowed to move any remains out of their collections. The ramifications have been long in coming, but most would agree that claims and negotiations are now in full swing.
There might be 60 to 80,000 skeletons in museums in the UK. I would guess 75 or 80% of them are not contested in any way.
Hedley Swain from the Museum of London.
Museums were slightly taken aback in the UK at just how strong some of the views being expressed by Indigenous people, for example, in Australia, were. And I think museums and museum people have had to overcome the fact that museums are used to controlling their collections, being the custodians of their collections, and starting from a point where once something is in a collection, it stays there, it isn't given away.
The Natural History Museum's Director of Science, Professor Richard Lane, was involved in the recent return of 17 Tasmanian remains. They're currently engaged in talks over others.
These are the first that we have actually returned. I think both parties started in one place and have ended up somewhere different. Quite a learning for both sides. For the museum community, I think it's about articulating more clearly the scientific benefits to the claimant communities, as opposed to the scientific benefits to all of us.
Those scientific benefits, he says, include the kind of information that DNA testing can provide about the ancient history of Aboriginal people and their way of life before colonial times, something they can put alongside their oral histories as part of their cultural heritage. But the Tasmanian Aboriginal Centre was against any interference with their remains. And they're not the only ones to challenge his scientists' view as no more and no less valid than their own.
Druidry is as old as Sikhism. Our folklore, our ancestry, our mythology goes back thousands and thousands of years.
Emma Restall Orr is a pagan priest.
Bones retain some of the spirit of the person that has died. They're taking up museum space and resources, and they're offensive to the pagan community to stay dry. We need them back in the wet ground, to dissolve into the mud, to be a part of the cycle of life and death, to continue their journey to the other land, if you like.
It's not a genealogical claim, but pagans here are asking to be heard on the treatment and display of pre-Christian human remains. Some curators struggle with the idea that modern European pagans could have a right of claim equal to Aboriginal communities. But leaving genocide, oppression and land theft aside, British pagans see little division between their beliefs and Aboriginal beliefs.
Pagan is pagan, wherever you are in the world. Aboriginal beliefs, North American, Indian beliefs, First Nation Canadians, Siberian, even the Shinto beliefs of Japan, including Hinduism. Paganism is about the human interaction, reverence for the land. What we're saying is that there is another notion of indigeneity. British people here in this land feel connected to those who have been here before.
Such beliefs do present a challenge to British museums to be more interactive and inclusive, to explain and consult more, and display remains more sensitively. Hedley Swain again from the Museum of London.
What will probably happen over the next couple of years is it will be clarified which remains will almost automatically go back and which won't. The scientific community has got to get its act together and really decide what the value of this material is, and it's got to argue the case why material shouldn't be reburied. And I've yet to see whether that's possible. For people to come into contact with skeletons is still a very powerful medium of communication. You know, you're coming into contact with real people from the past, but we need to think carefully about the nature of it.
Emma Restall Orr again.
Things are starting to change, and within 10 years, I think museums will look very different. Reburial will be a standard procedure. Community consultation groups will necessarily be a part of all museums' decision-making process. I think museums have a huge amount to gain as they start to become more accountable to community, they will gain the support and the input of the population and become far more useful, interactive, vibrant at the moment as they disappear into their ivory towers of outdated colonialism. They are losing their relevance very quickly.
Professor Richard Lane of the Natural History Museum believes to some extent the gulf between museums and the various interested groups can be bridged.
We always acknowledged from the very beginning that this was going to be extremely difficult because we've got two views of the world which appear on the surface to be contradictory. Often when we explore more deeply, we find they're not quite so contradictory as it might appear. I don't think we've been arrogant. I think there are times when we haven't been as engaged as other parts of science in, say, biodiversity research and conservation. We engage with local communities much more and more often. So perhaps we'll bring the anthropological world into line with what goes on in biodiversity research.
Whether these different views on the world can be reconciled or not, museums are now talking to diverse groups across the world. Some returns and reburials are taking place, and that could mark the beginnings of a break from the authoritarianism some accuse them of towards a new era for museums and science. This is Naomi Fowler in the Museum of London for The Science Show.
If you look at the 10 hottest years ever measured, they've all occurred in the last 14 years. And the hottest of all was 2005. The scientific consensus is that we are causing global warming.
King of the PowerPoint presentation, Al Gore. But most PowerPoint people aren't kings. Death by PowerPoint is more likely. And they should by now know better, as science communication student Nikki Phillips has found.
Up until just a few years ago, a talk or presentation consisted of a speaker with maybe a slide or two by way of illustration. Now, it seems a talk isn't a talk without the use of PowerPoint, the computer program which allows graphs, tables and words to be projected on a screen behind the speaker, images flying in and out, dazzling the audience. And it's used almost everywhere, university lectures, business presentations, and conferences. Al Gore made extensive use of PowerPoint in his film An Inconvenient Truth. Some speakers take the easy road and just read their presentations, using PowerPoint to project pages of text and statistics. But often audiences are left confused, unable to follow, let alone retain the information. University of New South Wales Professor John Sweller believes this easy-to-use teaching tool isn't really teaching at all. Professor Sweller, who conducted research back in the late 1990s on efficiency in learning, suggests that the same material presented to audiences in both written and verbal form simultaneously, as in a PowerPoint presentation, is too much for the brain to digest. Interestingly, the initial focus of this research was on good old transparencies, which were at the height of their popularity 10 years ago. So if this research came out almost a decade ago, why the sudden interest? Professor Sweller explains.
The interest comes about because of the rise of PowerPoint. When the research was initially carried out, PowerPoint existed but was very, very rarely used. It was a very new technology. As people started using it, they began to realise how easy it was to present huge slabs of information in written form and simultaneously in spoken form. People readily assumed that this was a good way of getting people to understand and learn what was being presented.
According to Professor Sweller, it's not necessarily the content of a presentation that's got audiences muddled, it's the way the information is presented.
All novel information is processed by a very, very limited working memory. Now, it's limited in two respects. The first limitation is with respect to capacity. We can only take in 2, 3, maybe 4 categories of information at any given time. Anything more than that overloads working memory. We can only hold information in working memory for literally 10, maybe at the most 20 seconds and probably less without rehearsal. So working memory is very limited, and if you don't take into account that limitation of working memory, which all of us have to use when we're presented with new material, then that new material is likely to be difficult to process. Since the introduction of PowerPoint, it's become easier and easier to put up huge amounts of text, and people feel, because it's so easy, that's advantageous. And it's probably advantageous from the point of view of the speaker. It makes it easier to give your talk. It's just that it's almost unintelligible in some cases from the point of view of one's audience.
The research conducted by Professor Sweller suggests that a presentation that stimulates both visual and auditory responses with large slabs of text is a waste of the working memory and little is retained.
Redundancy effect occurs when the same material is presented in multiple forms. For example, if you present the same material in spoken and written form. And we've found repeatedly in a whole variety of circumstances that if you present people with redundant information, that overloads working memory, will simply collapse in effect. The material won't be assimilated, won't be understood, and won't be learned.
So does this mean PowerPoint presentations are a waste of time? How can you give an effective presentation that ensures your listeners will understand and remember what you're trying to get across?
If you're giving a talk, you should do just that, talk. If, on the other hand, somebody presents, for example, a graph or a diagram or a picture and says something about that picture, we've evolved to handle that sort of material. We do that all the time, and our ancestors did that sort of thing for many, many hundreds of thousands of years. We have no difficulty with that. So if on your PowerPoint you put up some sort of visual information, like a picture or a graph, and you speak to it, that's perfectly okay.
What about when data is used in graphs and tables? Is that acceptable? Can we process that?
Graphs being largely visual in nature, we can process those quite readily, and they're a good way of presenting information in an efficient, concise form. Tables of figures are okay if they're limited, but I've been to presentations where people have presented an entire wall of figures and one wonders what the point of that is.
So next time you're asked to give a presentation, remember, walls of text and overcrowded data tables are a poor way to convey a message. You're better off using pictures, diagrams, and even a good joke to stimulate and maybe entertain your audience.
Nikki Phillips from the University of New South Wales, and entertain with PowerPoint is just what Nobel laureate Paul Nurse did at La Trobe University this week. Here's an extract with more on complexity, our theme for this science show.
I think it may lead to some very strange outcomes. At the turn of the 20th century, physics underwent a dramatic transformation. Pre-1900, physics inhabited most of the time a common sense world. When you think of Newtonian physics, you can imagine it in your head. You know, a billiard ball hitting another billiard ball, and you can sort of imagine it. Then we had Einstein's theory of relativity. And you read it, you think you've got it, then you close the book and it's slipped away again, you know? And most of the time we think we're just too stupid to understand it. Now, that's hard enough with relativity, but when you get to quantum mechanics 20 years later, you are truly in Alice in Wonderland world. And I defy any of you to have a common sense view of quantum mechanics where Schrödinger's cat can be both alive and dead in the box at the same time. We can't do it. And the reason we can't do it is because we've moved out from the common sense world into something strange. Now, what I'm suggesting here is that biology is getting now so complicated that we are possibly going to move from this common sense understanding of the world into a sort of more non-intuitive 21st century biology. And we have to be brave enough to embrace the fact that we can perhaps no longer build billiard ball pictures of what's going on in living things, that we're going to actually have to get help from mathematicians, computing engineers, to make sense of all this complexity.
Nobel laureate Paul Nurse at La Trobe University this week, with complexity, the final statement. He's on The Science Show at greater length next week. Until then, try to keep it simple. I'm Robin Williams.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.